in behind you. Over a decreased LOC. Male in his 30s, found unconscious, possible overdose. Had three naloxone, eyes are opening, performance.
We have a male 32 years of age. He hit his head, he's bleeding profusely. He's on the main floor of the building. He hit his head on the
bed. It's the Novo Hotel. Go to the lobby there. Staff on the allergic reaction. Female in her 30s, short of breath, swollen tongue, swollen throat, hard to swallow. No FDA on scene.
Welcome to the Remember That Patient podcast, a Canadian-based EMS podcast that endeavors to use actual case review to improve the education of paramedics and outcomes of patients. I'll be your host, Jeffrey Billick. Myself and my team of hosts will be with you to guide you along through these various cases, and we hope you'll find them helpful. Joining me for this month for episode one, which we've titled Beyond the Toxidrome, is Andrew Burns. We won't bore you with our bios. They're all available on our website if you're curious. Andrew, thanks for joining me on our first episode.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to introduce our first case. Our first case was an actual call that happened somewhere in Canada. Obviously, the location and patient privacy details are certainly anonymized. So, with no further ado, our paramedic crew responds on an urgent response lights and sirens for a male patient in his mid-20s reported as unconscious, and this is in the late night hours. Upon arrival, the crew meets the patient's father. The father is exasperated, states that he came home from a friend's house and he found his son unconscious on the living room floor. Nothing in disarray. There's nothing around him. There's no obvious trauma noted to the patient. And just has no idea what happened. So you find the patient in that same situation, unconscious, living room. As I said, there's nothing really around, nothing in disarray. You don't see any obvious trauma. The father says, as far as medical history goes, he has no real history, no prescription meds. However, years ago, the patient did struggle quite a bit with severe cocaine abuse. That being said, the patient has been doing well over the last year, year and a half, and his understanding is that the patient is cocaine use free for the last 8 months. He's not sure about any other recreational or prescription drug use, but says it's probably unlikely. He does have a little drink once in a while, but again, he's never been known to kind of come home and be severely intoxicated on alcohol either. All the father's prescription meds are accounted for in the house, and they're undisturbed. So into the living room you go, you find the patient GCS3, flushed, sweaty, but not overly diaphoretic. Initial vital signs come back for you with a heart rate of 128 regular with some ECG abnormalities that we'll talk about in a minute. Respiratory rate slightly irregular in the range of 20 to 22. SpO2 88% on room air. Blood sugar value of 7.2. An auscultated blood pressure of 82 over 54, and a temperature of 37.5 Celsius. So that's what you're left with on the surface. Don't really know a whole lot of information other than the fact that the patient used to take cocaine frequently. Not really sure if that's the case now. So just based on that alone, Andrew, where's our kind of brain thinking here? Obviously, we need to keep things pretty broad at this point with the minimal info that we have.
Yeah, so I think start with the basics. ABCs, manage what we can, you know, sort of broadly, not knowing necessarily what's going on, but just going back to our basics. BLS airways, NPAs, OPAs, if he'll tolerate them, jaw thrust, and that buying us some time to apply some oxygen, hopefully get the sats up just passively. I'd like to know, with that respiratory rate of 20, are those deep breaths, are those shallow breaths? You know, what's their minute volume looking like? And if we had NTIDAL, this would certainly be a patient who would benefit from applying that as well. I missed it. Did we get a blood sugar on him at this point?
Yeah, we did. So some great questions. So further to that, so we do have a blood sugar value of 7.2. As far as asking the kind of respiratory rate and effort, obviously, right? Yeah, just a single number means nothing, right? So great 2022, but let's dig a little bit deeper into that. So what we have here is it looks like they're, for the most part, rather shallow, just kind of not quite guppy breaths per se, but rather shallow at that rate, which that may be what we're attributing that SAT of 88% to. So, and yes, an OPA was inserted and tolerated.
Perfect. And then the other thing I don't think, maybe have this information, maybe you don't, but pupils, did we get a chance to look at those?
I have them down here as 4 to 5, but not really very reactive at all. Not quite fixed per se, but pretty sluggish at 4 to 5.
Okay. So I think that gives us a pretty good overview of our assessment at this point. The last thing I wanted to touch base on, though, was that 12 lead. So in these cases of we're not really sure what's going on, the 12 lead can give us a lot of answers. You did say that there were some irregularities with that. Can you clarify that at all?
Yeah, for sure. Obviously, pretty important. In this case, a 12 lead was not done initially. So it was done out in the truck,
okay,
which is a little bit later, which of course potentially may have been different than on the scene. And we will certainly throw the ECG that we're referring to down into the show notes for you. So, but spitting that 12 lead out in the back of the truck, like this crew did here, what they saw is kind of not, I wouldn't call it a wide complex, but kind of borderline. So kind of getting above that 0.012 range, some really, really large, segments in V2 and V3 as far as QRS voltage goes, along with hyperacute T waves, kind of a positive dominant R wave up in AVR, and then obviously our tachycardic rate as well. So for those non-ECG gurus, you recognize right away, like there's something off here. It doesn't look entirely normal. There may be some mild depression. There's no elevation at all, but we can certainly tell that it's not quite a normal ECG.
Okay, perfect. So you definitely said some key trigger words there that got me pointed in certain directions. So let's just stop and kind of recap. So we've got a patient who's GCS3, not protecting his airway. He's tachycardic. Saturation's not great on room air, hopefully a little bit better with oxygen. Blood sugar is normal. They are hypotensive. They have a wide QRS complex and a R wave and AVR. And the other piece was dilated pupils or normal to sort of dilated pupils. So that puts us into a few different categories. So why don't we stop and kind of just talk about that for a second? So obviously with the father mentioning cocaine, that needs to be on our list of differentials. And, as we all know at this day and age, just because you think you're taking cocaine, that doesn't mean that that is all that's in it. So we always have to think about the adulterants or other agents that could be added to it. Opioids. Doesn't sound like this is necessarily opioid related given the pupils looking like they are, but not something that I would rule out. Also with the respiratory rate of 22, maybe less likely. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, obviously we're, you know, at least here in Ontario, our listeners are going to be all over the place. But here in Ontario, right, we're not in the business of using naloxone as a diagnostic tool pre-hospitally anyway. So it doesn't, obviously, yeah, put it in your pocket, but it certainly does ring up high for me.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's something that we have to sort of tick off our list and our differentials, but probably not going to be super high yield for us in this case. So let's talk about the cocaine. It fits and it doesn't fit, I think is kind of the best way to talk about that. And coming back to the title of this case, toxidromes, let's just talk for a second about the toxidrome that cocaine does give you. So typically it's going to be a sympathetic toxidrome. Unfortunately, there's no great fancy mnemonic for this one to make it easy to remember. It's just one of those ones that you kind of have to plug into your head. But typically they're going to be tachycardic, which this patient fits. They'll have hypertension most of the time. Doesn't quite fit in this case. They'll be diaphoretic. I think you said in this case, a little diaphoretic, but nothing over the top. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Agitation, definitely not with a GCS of 3. Hyperthermia, a little on the warm side, but definitely nothing out of the ordinary. Cardiac arrhythmias. So we might be seeing some ECG changes at this point, but it still does sound like a sinus tachycardia. Seizures, which are not happening. And then dilated pupils, which we are seeing at this point. So fits, but doesn't fit. What are your thoughts on that at this point? Seems more likely than opioids, but still not quite a slam dunk.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the crew was probably kind of mildly confused at this point as well, right? We go back to that sympathomimetic toxidrome way back in PCP school, right? And like you say, we're checking off some of the boxes there. And I think that's why when this case was given to us, the crew alluded to, like, nothing was out of place around the house, right? It doesn't sound like we're on the tail end or the opposite end of a period of severe agitation and then getting into an acidosis and then unresponsiveness, right? So
yeah,
not to say that didn't happen. Maybe he just didn't ruin stuff around the house, right? But it was good for them to sort of go down that road and pick
Absolutely.
Up on that, right? Like, it didn't appear that there was just some crazed episode and then eventually he just got acidotic and et cetera, right? And that cascade. So
and having having the wherewithal to take a step back in these patients where we're not sure what's going on and look at the whole picture, look at the condition of the room around you, get those clues wherever you can, take time to ask the family to go count their pills. We just don't know what's going on. We don't know what's going to be important and what's not. So trying to get as broad a picture as possible is super helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it sounds like in speaking with these paramedics, or at least one of them, it sounds like they did that right away. Like, they had dad go get his prescription medication. And so to think of that right out of the gate, that I think that was good.
Yeah, 100%. So that leaves us with all of the other things that are outside of this. Tachycardic hypotensive cardiogenic shock, that's a possibility. A cerebrovascular accident, absolutely a possibility as well. An occult bleed, less likely if we're not seeing evidence of that around the house. Not on PPIs or anything that we know of that would sort of point us in that direction, but all things that we have to keep on our differential as well. So now that the crew kind of figured all that stuff out, do you want to talk about their next steps and what their treatment was? Or
And this is kind of where it shifts a little bit in the sense that I think they felt they did a little bit of wrong here. And I would, as a whole, as we've kind of already talked about, I think they did well overall, right? So there was a discussion there kind of on scene about whether or not to call for ALS. I'll mention this crew was PCP IV, autonomous times two, so both of them. And there was a discussion on scene whether or not to bother with that. And they said, well, you know, he's protecting his own airway. We've got an OPA in. The SATs have come up with a non-rebreather. And we can fix this hypotension, right? And that was kind of the premise there. So they didn't bother. They decided to extricate out to the ambulance, and that's when an IV was established there. So they did hang around on scene. Obviously, the map here is not great, and so they decided to just take a couple seconds before departing to make sure that they were successful in that IV initiation and commenced the fluid bolus. So extricated out with a MANTA mat device. IV initiated about 600 to 700 cc's of fluid en route. Doesn't mention transport time, but if we're doing our fluid math here, we can gather that it was nothing unreasonable, probably in the realm of 10 to 15 minutes, I would imagine. And then kind of hit the wall, so 600 cc's of fluid in, and as they're a couple minutes out from the emergency department, the next blood pressure auscultated comes back now even lower. At 70 over 46.
Well, that's no good.
So what are you thinking there, Andrew? Like, we thought we maybe were able to fix this, right? And now that's not working.
Yeah. I mean, not all shock is amenable to fluids as a fix, right? Sometimes fluid is just not the answer. And sometimes 600 cc's is just not going to get you anywhere close. Who knows what case was in this particular patient. But we still kind of haven't figured out exactly what the problem is. We've got some clues, but I think everything they've done so far is 100% reasonable. I think you start at the basics, and the basics is throw some fluid in this person and see what happens. Unfortunately, this guy didn't read the textbook and things didn't go the way they expected them to, right?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, transported at arrival, handover was made. They did also note as they were getting closer to the hospital that there was an increase in the amount of ectopy. And it looks like unifocal PVCs, but becoming more and more frequent. Does that give you any other clue at all?
So it does. I mean, it could be from a whole slew of different things. It could be from the fact that he was probably hypoventilating for a while and had some level of acidosis. We don't know how long this gentleman had been on the ground. You know, is there an element of rhabdo that's happening? What's his lactate doing? Again, end title here could give us some clues. Or it could just be that whatever pathology is causing these issues is just continuing to progress. So again, serial 12 leads, I think here would be super important. Do we see an evolving OMI pattern? Anything else that's concerning? Has our cure restoration prolonged anymore? Those are the kind of things that you're just going to have to keep an eye on. Unfortunately, a lot of that isn't stuff that we can act on all the time in the pre-hospital environment, but are super important clues to be able to pass on to our colleagues in the hospital as they continue to kind of dig through this patient and figure out what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for certainly ectopy could be a myriad of different causes, right? And I mean, it certainly tells us, I think you kind of nailed it, right? Whatever's going on here is probably still continuing to go on and make things worse. So at this point, we've transferred that care, the handover has been made, the report's been made. The emergency department decides to do another 12 lead. We only have one pre-hospital 12 lead. There wasn't another one done prior to arrival. So on the ED pre-hospital 12 lead, we see a significant more widening of that QRS, which kind of may help us kind of steer in the right direction just on that alone, right? So first of all, it's different than the first one, which, right, typically not good, right? When they're changing while they're with us.
Absolutely, so, yeah.
The rate has come up a bit. We're in the upper 150s now, and the QRS is significantly more wide. So as we're probably all wondering, where are we going with this case here? So the emergency department, in recognizing that 12 lead, and we talked about that really early in this case, and the emergency department doc kind of recognized right away that pattern, and it can only be a few different things. And as I said, we'll put the pre-hospital ECG in the show notes for you to see, but in recognizing the pattern plus the whole story, of course, right? Everything that's gone on and everything that the pre-hospital crew has done, and you know, added some fluid, it's had no effect, the pressure's even worse now, and now we have an increase in rate and a widening QRS. So ultimately the ED physician decided to push sodium bicarb 2 amps, relatively quick, short time frame, and within 10 minutes the crew kind of stuck around. Obviously that's where we're getting some of this data. They noticed that the GCS slightly improves and a significant increase in blood pressure and decrease in that QRS width. So does that tell us anything else here, Andrew?
Yeah, it tells us the bicarb worked. The question is, why did it work, right? So if we're going to go down the cocaine toxicity route, even though he doesn't fit that toxidome perfectly, it seems like the most likely sort of differential at this point. Cocaine actually does work at high doses as a sodium channel blocker. So with that, we would see, similar to a tricyclic overdose, the widening of the QRS as well as that terminal R wave and AVR are pretty classic signs of a sodium channel blocker toxicity. And fixing that with sodium bicarb, which is just essentially super salty water, giving that sort of sodium bolus to the system, you'll see those signs change fairly quickly. And it really, at that point, is just supportive care to help the patient ride out the duration of that toxin being in their body. So makes sense to me, and seems to kind of confirm our biggest differential, cocaine toxicity, just a very atypical presentation of it.
Yeah, atypical for sure. And I'm glad you kind of brought up the TCA, because we all kind of learn about that TCA overdose and ECG early in our paramedic schooling as well. And it's not quite that distinct look as a TCA. And again, go down there, take a look at it. You'll see it doesn't look as, I'm just going to use some simple terms here, Andrew, it doesn't look as funky as like a flat out TCA overdose, but certainly the things that you touched on are certainly present there as well. So let's talk about that, because I don't think we really, at least for me in PCP education, right, when I learned about cocaine and other sympathomimetics, there was just zero mention of sodium channel blockade. And as you point out, it is atypical. This is a little bit of a red herring. We're not going to find this frequently in cocaine toxicity. We will typically be met with the tachycardia, chest pain, right? Maybe we're going to treat with some nitrates. Maybe we're going to treat with benzos at the ALS level. But obviously, so not something that's dominant, but how does it occur?
All right. So now that we know that our original differential was right, this was probably just a massive cocaine ingestion, let's take a second just to review what cocaine does to our body, how it works, and then we can dive a little bit deeper into how we can best support these patients. So first off, where do the euphoric uplifting effects of cocaine come from? Really simply, it blocks the reuptake of serotonin. Our body continues to produce it. The cocaine says, nope, sorry, not going to let you break that down. We end up with elevated levels of serotonin that gives us the euphoric feeling. The problem comes on the sympathetic side of the house with it also stimulating alpha 1, alpha 2, beta 1, and beta 2, and then acting, like we talked about before, as a sodium channel blocker.
And the other thing too, I'll just kind of add, Andrew, that obviously as far as dosing goes, right, much like any drug, right, it's going to be the route, it's going to be the amount taken. We're not going to really talk about polypharm, but whether there's other polypharm stuff in there with it, right? But ultimately the dosing is highly variable. If I take 20 milligrams, it might have a very different effect on me than you taking 20 milligrams, right?
Absolutely. And especially, I think one of the key pieces of what the father said in this patient's case is he hadn't done it for 8 months. So he may have remembered sort of what a typical dose was for him 8 months ago. Now you've been away from it for 8 months, going back to that same dose is going to have very different effects than it would have had he never stopped. And that could be part of his problem right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. Similar to the folks on that have opioid use disorder, right? And they stop for a year or whatever the case may be, right? And they all of a sudden resume again and thinking that I need to hit X for a dose, right? And then they end up in trouble.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so we know it's a serotonin reuptake inhibitor. We know it hits alpha 1, alpha 2, beta 1, beta 2. We know it's a sodium channel blocker. How does it present? Neurologically, we'll see euphoria, anxiety, agitation, aggression, paranoia, even sometimes hallucinations. With that sympathetic side, we'll see hyperthermia, we'll see rigidity, we'll see myoclonic movements, and in severe cases, we can even see seizures. On the cardiovascular side of the house, people are going to be tachycardic and usually fairly, if not profoundly, hypertensive. This can lead to arrhythmias, cardiac conduction abnormalities. Those can be from the sodium channel blockade. They can also just be from the hypertension itself, causing cardiac ischemia. We can see vasospasm in these patients. We can see thrombus formation, QT prolongation, and then acute pulmonary edema as their heart starts to fail on us. Other complications with these patients when they get into these really hypertensive crises, we see vessel ruptures. So that could manifest as a bleed in the brain, or a ruptured aneurysm elsewhere in the body. Really, they can get into some pretty nasty situations if that hypertension isn't dealt with. And then we can also see them putting themselves into a rhabdo as a result of all of this.
Mm-hmm. And that could have even been the case here, right? Like maybe there was a severe agitation period prolonged. Again, we don't know how long he was in the house there. Certainly a good differential. I think we touched on that earlier about keeping rhabdo up there too.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of that may explain his hypotension. If he did experience some of that vasospasm in his coronary arteries, he could have had a period of just LV failure. Mm-hmm. And that's why he was so hypotensive at that point.
That being said, we know that this kind of worked. And we've touched on some of the aspects of sodium channel blockade. So you've kind of touched on the sodium bicarb, Andrew. You did mention one other treatment in there that was possible as well. And I've seen that on some of the treatment sort of algorithms in some places. So what was the other one you had there?
I'm thinking lidocaine. Is that what you're
pointing
towards? Yeah. Yeah, so interesting that you're using a sodium channel blocker to treat a sodium channel blocker. But really, it just comes down to getting those two to kind of duke it out inside the body. Lidocaine, we know, is going to be a little bit friendlier. And I believe the thought behind the lidocaine is it forces the that cocaine blockade out of the way and replaces it with the lidocaine blockade.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I always kind of liken it to the naloxone, right? Just fighting off the opioid off the MU receptor. So same kind of concept here. So it seems totally backwards to do lidocaine, and it is a second line. So we reserve the lidocaine for when sodium bicarb doesn't work. But it's exactly like you say. So it's gonna sort of fight off the cocaine off of those receptors, and it's gonna have a stronger bond. Like I said, if you just liken it to naloxone bumping off the opioid, it's the same concept applies, right? As backwards thinking as it is, it's going to have more of a binding factor and take to that receptor more. So,
yeah, that's a great point with the lidocaine. And we just want to remember, with a lot of services now moving away from lidocaine and starting to carry only amio, when it comes to these toxicological patients, amio really hits a lot of different receptors and different routes. So lidocaine often is sort of the preferred agent just because it's much more specific, much more targeted, and not quite as broadly acting as amio is.
Yeah, yeah, I'm lucky. I'm still holding on to lido where I am. So
nice.
I don't want to use the word safer, but when you have no idea what you're dealing with, it kind of is a little bit safer, right?
It's more specific, right? Yeah, it's much more targeted.
Yeah, you might have a little bit of less efficacy in some specific circumstances, but when you're throwing it at a question mark, I think it's probably the way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so Jeff, this was definitely a patient that didn't read the textbook. I think it serves as a great lesson to remind us that we need to keep a wide differential, and we need to use all the tools that are available to us in the pre-hospital environment to try and figure out what these patients' stories are. The crew did a great job of addressing the basics and treating the basics, which is, if you read any sort of overdose or toxicological treatment flow, it always starts with just deal with the basics, support them, the patient, as needed, and then start working through your investigations to figure out what's going on. And it seems like that's exactly what this crew did. So good job to them. I can understand why they'd be a little bit frustrated, because it definitely doesn't fit the mental model of what a cocaine toxicity normally looks like. Yeah, but they did what they could, and they did the right things and got the patient to the right place and the right people who made things work for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. They, in speaking and doing the background interview, for sure, they were kind of beating themselves up. So eventually they did find out the next day that there was no other polypharm involvement. There was just ultimately cocaine in the system only in a significant amount. And sometimes outcome, we all love outcome info, but like sometimes it can, when it supports us and tells us we're right, it's an easy pill to swallow. We pat ourselves on the back when it says we were wrong. Sometimes it's a hard pill to swallow, right? But like you said, I don't think the crew really did anything wrong here. They failed to recognize something that was way out in left field, which that probably happens more often than we think on this job. We just don't have that outcome data to tell us that, right? So, yeah, I think they did a great job. And
yeah, absolutely.
They noticed a few of the check boxes that were in that toxidrome and treated things that were there symptomatically. They had some mild respiratory issue that they fixed, right? They did do an IV. They tried to bring the MAP up a little bit. It didn't work. Oh, well, it was something worth trying, right? And ultimately, they recognize this guy's pretty sick. We need to go and get them to definitive care. So, yeah, certainly the one-offs that we don't want to start searching for them in every case. However, it was great to sort of present this case and look at this one-off event. And kind of what you alluded to right in the beginning is keep that differential very broad, right? And obviously, in this case, it was a little bit of a red herring, but certainly something worth knowing, because again, when I've had this case actually, and it wasn't this severe, but similar circumstances, and I was able to recognize that that ECG actually I did treat with bicarb, which one dose had some moderate improvement. So that being said, I think it is a good case still to review, because the reality is maybe I was hung over that day, but I remember nothing about sodium channel blockade when kind of going through cocaine and sympathomimetic stuff, yeah. Right? So,
which is funny, because that's why it was used as an anesthetic agent, was for its sodium channel blocking properties, right? So it's definitely in there. It's just not the typical presentation we see in the field.
And that wraps up episode 1, Beyond the Toxidrome. To review, as with any tox cases, remember to keep a broad diagnosis early on, despite what bystanders may be able to help you with. Conduct a 12-lead ECG early in tox cases, especially with altered mental status. It may help clue you into some possible disturbances. Remember that not all patients suffering from sympathomimetic toxicity will follow the toxidrome. While the overwhelming majority will present with many of the symptoms we've discussed, there's always going to be outliers. Excessive cocaine use can cause severe agitation or excited delirium syndrome, which, if left untreated, can go on to further cause more severe conditions, such as metabolic acidosis and rhabdo. This can be treated with cooling and administration of IV fluids. And like in this case, remember that cocaine is inherently a sodium channel blocker. Cocaine toxicity can cause worsening cardiac effects, including hypotension, ectopy, and dysrhythmia, such as VT. This blockade can be treated pre-hospitally with sodium bicarb and lidocaine for blockade that is refractory to bicarb treatment. In this instance, it was unrecognized by this paramedic crew. And during background, one paramedic said to me, "I got led astray and really messed this one up. I'm hoping my failure in this case can help other providers." While somewhat true, I'd argue that this crew did a great job. They dug really deep around the scene with respects to the incident history, corrected what they could immediately, recognized when other treatments weren't working, and got the patient to definitive care with a story and diagnostics that allowed the patient to be treated immediately on arrival and with a good final outcome. While I'm sure it doesn't need to be mentioned here, be sure to always follow all your local protocols and medical directives. I'd like to thank Andrew Burns for joining me on this first episode. Stay tuned soon for episode 2 next month, where we will review a trauma case and some surrounding literature as well. Please be sure to subscribe to our podcast on all your favorite listening platforms and help us grow by sharing on your social media platforms. And if you have an interesting case that you think would be beneficial to our listeners, drop us a line anytime at mail@rtpshow.com. Do not include any particulars in your initial email. Simply let us know that you have a case for us, and we'll guide you through properly giving us information in a way that respects patient privacy. Thanks for listening, and we'll hope you'll join us again.